Space wants you.
We're going back to the moon and then to Mars.
Wanna go to space? Let's go.
Just getting to space is the easiest part.
Draw it, write it, build it, dream it, innovate it, invent it.
Because once you get to space, you actually have to live in it. Space wants you dead.
Let's expand our thinking.
It's time to go outside of the box.
Let's go, go, go.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Cities in Space podcast, episode 3. We're here to help you find your future in space, and we're so happy you've joined us today. I'm your host, Holly Malier. Today, we are going to Mars. We have an incredible guest for you. He's known internationally for his analog work of the moon and Mars in the Arctic, as well as geological field studies of the Earth polar regions. Dr. Pascal Lee is the director at the Mars Institute, planetary scientist at SETI Institute, director of NASA Howden Mars Project, as well as a professor at Kepler Space University. Go Kepler! He's also an artist, published author, and public speaker. I have had the great privilege of listening to Dr. Lee multiple times and multiple venues over the past many years, and I can tell you that I always come away feeling quite a bit smarter. Our guest is going to be teaching us a lot today. So it might be helpful today for everyone to join in the discussion and first pull out a globe. Consider that Dr. Lee has spent considerable time in the Arctic, the northernmost region of the Earth, and likewise spent considerable time in Antarctica, the southernmost continent on Earth. Essentially, the two coldest places you can go, period. His research focuses on the history of water on Mars and planning for future human exploration of Mars. Dr. Lee has led over 30 expeditions to the Arctic and Antarctica to study the comparison between Mars and Earth. He is also an expert on Mars' two moons, Phobos and Deimos. And with that, welcome, Pascal.
Good to be with you, Holly. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. How are you doing? And are you getting into trouble?
Oh, I'm trying to stay out of trouble, but that's always difficult. Yes.
Well, I'm really excited to have you here today. I have really struggled with what I want to say on my interview with you. There's just so much I want to talk to you about. I even thought about just talking with you for an hour and then recording it on double speed for everybody. But I feel like that might not be that. Well, it might be kind of funny, but it might not be right. So where in the world are you right now, Pascal?
I'm at home in California.
Okay.
At Earth.
So a little bit about our show. Our mission is to reach every student everywhere. We want to create excitement in the current developments of the space industry and space exploration. And we want to introduce kids to opportunities to how they can get involved. And I'm even going to ask you a couple of questions about that later. One thing that makes us special, though, is we also give the students the opportunity to ask questions of you and our other guests before we record. This week, however, you have challenged students to take a look at Google Mars and choose a location which they think is good for humans to land on Mars and possibly be a habitable area for human settlement. And we have received submissions for you. We'll be talking about those later in the show. We also provide essential questions and projects for the classroom, which can be used alongside every episode. They can also be found for free on our website at steam-space.org. Okay, Pascal, are you ready to dive in? I have lots. All right.
Let's go.
We're diving. All right. I'd like to start with the Northern Hemisphere in the Arctic. Tell us what prompted you to start your work there. What were your goals? give us some of the history about why you chose this path.
Yeah, well, when I was a kid, I was always interested in space, space exploration. And of all the places you could travel to, Mars is probably the most reachable planet beyond the moon now. And I think that kids growing up today will actually have a real chance in their lifetimes to not only see humans travel to Mars, but maybe be among the humans who get to go. And I think this is going to be a very exciting adventure for all of humanity, because it's not, you know, just an astronaut traveling to Mars. It's all of humanity being part of the journey. Yeah. Now, if you look at Mars, what it is, it's a smaller planet than the Earth. It is colder than the Earth because it's farther from the sun than the Earth is. It's the next planet out. And if you took all the continents of the Earth and got rid of the oceans, but just took all the continents of the Earth and wrapped them into a smaller ball, you would get a ball the size of Mars. Mars's land area, Mars has no oceans today, but its land area is the same as all the continents of the Earth put together.
Wow.
But instead of having forests and parts that are, you know, vegetated and pleasant to live in, all of Mars is a cold, rocky, barren desert. All of it. And it even has polar caps, which are covered in ice, but not even water ice, although there is water ice there, mostly carbon dioxide ice. It is so cold there. So to find a place on Earth where you might get an idea of what Mars is like, why, you know, how the terrain could feel like, what sort of is shaping the landscape, you're going to turn very quickly to Earth's polar regions. Now, you've got two options there. You can go to Antarctica, where it's very cold, but pretty much entirely covered in ice. Or you go to the Arctic, where it's also cold, but not covered, mostly in ice. And we go to this place, we found this place called Devon Island. It's the largest uninhabited island on Earth. The whole island is a rocky, cold desert. We call that place Mars on Earth. And so, as I was growing up, I've been wanting to go there, and sure enough, it turned out to be what one might call Mars on Earth. It has a meteorite impact crater. It has canyons. It has valleys. It's missing sand dunes, so there's not a lot of that there, but plenty on Mars, of course. It's also missing volcanoes. But aside from that, it is Mars on Earth. And so we've been going up there, my teammates and I, for the past 25 years, every summer, to try to understand this place. And we think that it's teaching us a lot about Mars.
Wow. I mean, you know, I was going to ask you about Devon Island next. And like you said, it's the largest uninhabited island in the world. I have some questions to ask you about psychological things there. But I mean, when you initiated the Howden Mars project and began focusing on there, you did start some really intense, good field work, but I also know that you did this Northwest Passage drive, right? I love the Passage to Mars chronicling this. Can you talk a little bit about the expedition you did there and a little bit about the Howden Mars project? Because that's a collaboration, correct, with NASA, SETI, Mars Institute, and maybe some other private organizations. Is that correct?
That's correct. The Howden Mars Project is a project where NASA and academia, nonprofit research organizations, some schools, industry collaborate together. And what we have on Devon Island is a base camp. We have a remote, it's almost like a Mars base. We have a remote base camp. It stays up there year round. We ourselves, we go up there only in the summer because the rest of the year, the whole place is covered in snow. But in the summer, the snow disappears, and now you have this landscape that looks just like Mars. So we go up there for two reasons mainly. One is to study the rocks, the geology, the landscape, and try to figure out how Mars is the way it is. But the other thing we do is that we use the place as a testing ground for future exploration. If you are an astronaut, planning a trip to Mars, I can guarantee you that you want to spend time on Devon Island. You want to just get familiar with that landscape, the scale of things, the barrenness. If you look at a landscape, you know, near where most of us live, there's always something in the landscape that's giving you a sense of scale, a house on the horizon, maybe a power line, even an airplane in the sky. Up there, there is nothing. It's just rocks all the way to the horizon or canyons, but not a tree, not a house, not a power line, not a road, not a airplane contrail in the sky.
Wow.
Except once a week, there's a Hong Kong JFK flight that flies over that, but that's it. And so, you know, you're really left with a place that allows you to experience Mars like it might be when you go there. So to use this place to learn how to explore Mars,
we
take spacesuits up there to test them. We take instruments that we might deploy one day on Mars, but we most importantly take rovers. We take all kinds of vehicles to explore this desert and learn which are the best types of rovers to use on Mars one day when it's time for us to go. So one of the vehicles that we've been the most excited about is something that you would describe as a motorhome or an RV, a recreational vehicle, a home on wheels. And so unlike, you know, an open Jeep that you'd have to be driving in a spacesuit, and then you can only go so far with that because once you run out of oxygen, you're done. A motorhome protects you for long road trips. And so you are living inside in shirt sleeves. You don't have to be wearing a spacesuit when you're inside the rover. You can cook, you can sleep, you can work, you can, you know, plan your spacewalks. You get to a location that's interesting, you then don your spacesuit, and then you go out for your spacewalk. And then once you're done with your spacewalk, exploring, collecting samples, you climb back into your rover, your pressurized rover, and you move on. You move on to the next place. So this type of exploration is something we've been doing on Devon Island. And for that, we use two identical, although one's yellow, the other one's red, just so that we can recognize them on pictures. We use two identical modified military ambulance Humvees. Humvees are famous for being, you know, really rugged all-terrain vehicles that many military around the world use. But these are the ambulance versions because they have a tall cab at the back with sleeping bunks so that you can actually sleep inside your vehicle.
Are these are the vehicles that were in the film Passage to Mars, right?
That's right.
And I'm sure since then you've made even more adaptations to them, I'm assuming, because that was a few years ago, right?
Yeah, exactly. So Passage to Mars is just a documentary film. You can watch it on Amazon or other places.
Highly suggest it. Okay.
Passage to Mars talks about how we got one of these Humvee rovers from down south all the way to Devon Island. And we actually drove it there. We drove it there, even though it's an island, we drove it there in the winter on sea ice when the sea was frozen. And in fact, this expedition holds the world record for the longest stretch of sea ice driven in a road vehicle.
Wow. With the Howden Mars project, you know, being a joint international interdisciplinary project, you're having to work with a lot of different perspectives, cultures, languages, with all different people. I mean, this is great, right? Because this is what we're going to be experiencing, creating bases and, you know, global collaborative projects off world, right? But what are some of those challenges and opportunities that have come up on Devon Island doing these projects?
You know, that's a good question. Working with international teams is really an eye opener. Mm-hmm. You know, I personally grew up, I mean, I was born, not by my choosing, but just so happened to be born in Hong Kong. So, you know, in one end of Asia. And then I grew up in France. And then I came to America for graduate school and studied astronomy. And then came to California to work at NASA. And during this whole process, I've lost track of you know, any particular home country. I feel like I'm a citizen of the earth. I grew up on this planet, and I have friends and family everywhere. And it's a perspective that I find again in this international project that we run, because you're right, there are people from all corners of the earth. And the beauty about working on something like going to Mars or even the moon is that you realize that even though you might be representing a country, you're really going there as ambassadors of humanity, and you represent humanity. There are the hopes and dreams of many people behind your journey. And, you shouldn't shy away, I think, from that perspective. It's just wonderful to be a human being traveling to another world. It's not to say that you should ignore differences between people. There are, like you said, cultural differences, language differences. You just gain a real appreciation for that diversity that is behind humanity. But at the same time, it also allows you to focus on what ultimately is something you share in common with all other human beings on the planet.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, traveling to Mars is something that I think has that dimension. You're bringing your own culture to Mars as you travel, but at the same time, you're really doing something that is going to be representing an effort of all humanity.
Yeah, I agree. I love that. So, you've spent 400 days in Antarctica, switching to the Southern Hemisphere, which you've already discussed that's more ice covered. I'm going to say the station and then you can laugh at me on cue because I do not speak French and my cousins would be horrified. Sorry. Dumont d'Urville. Okay, now you say it.
Dumont d'Urville.
It sounds much different. Okay, so both these places are so cold. I'm based in Austin, Texas. And I mean, generally for Devon Island, you do your field work in the summer, correct?
Yes, you do your field work in the summer. Antarctica and my spending time at Dumont d'Urville Station was a different part of my life. At the time, I was just fresh out of studying geology and geophysics in school in France, in Paris, at the university. And I had to go spend a year, for my national service at the time. There was a draft in France, so all young men had to spend a year in the military. And so instead of doing that, I applied for this one position that they had each year for scientists to go to Antarctica instead of being technically in the military. We were doing the scientific service, basically, to go to Antarctica and rough it out down there, if you will. Anyway, that was my choice. So I applied 3 years ahead of time for this one position that they had each year for geologists. And I was lucky. I got the offer. And that was a life-changing experience for me because I went down to Antarctica, not just for a quick visit, but to spend a year there.
Wow.
And you could only take so much stuff with you. You had to pick very carefully what you took with you to fill your time, any free time you might have. Like, which books would you pick, possibly? And this was a time when there was no internet. So it's not like you could go over there and, keep yourself busy by being online.
Right.
There's none of that yet. And so I spent 402 days in this station. My job was to study the geology and measure the magnetic field of the Earth. So this was geophysics. You study the Earth's magnetic field, which varies all the time, all day long, and also earthquakes. I was able to, with the instruments there, detect earthquakes that were taking place halfway, if not all the way across the globe of the Earth.
Wow.
And detect them still down there. So anyway, it was an amazing experience and adventure. And the most relevant part to a mission to Mars from that experience is probably the fact that we live in a very small, confined group. We were isolated. For some of my friends, it was clearly psychologically pretty difficult. Mm-hmm. I mean, I personally kept happy and busy with just, discovering the place, the work. But some were really missing home. And, you know, you, there's nothing you can do about it if you start missing home.
Right. Right. You've done psychological studies in Devon Island, right? About isolation as well as immune system and psychological issues. I'd love to hear just a minute about that and also just how you have kept yourself sane. And how do you deal with the cold? I mean, even in the summer, how cold does it get? Tell me how cold it gets, really.
It's cold. I mean, in the summer, it's not too bad. It's like, you know, an early spring day in Chicago is what the summer is like. So, you know, it can be a little nippy, but it's not too bad. And it does get to sub-freezing temperatures, so you have to be careful. You know, if you drink a little cup of tea before you go to bed and hide in your sleeping bag the next morning, you know, the tea bag will be all frozen. And
that seems a little more than nippy. That's a little more than a nippy, but spring day. It's
nothing compared to even, you know, people who are hiking in at high altitude in mountains and all that. So it's in that range of experiences. But to me, the thing that I find the most exciting about being there is that you're in this landscape that looks just like Mars. And, you know, one of the most powerful experiences that I've ever had up there was to, I mean, you know, once you've woken up and had your coffee and you're up and running, is to put on a spacesuit that we're testing. And you have engineers who are there, who are the spacesuit experts, who are, you know, helping you put it on and turn everything on and make sure you can breathe and all that. You put on the spacesuit and then you turn around, you face this landscape. And gosh, it's like the closest thing one can really experience to being on Mars that's available. I mean, you know, even being on the space station doesn't do that for you.
Right.
Here you are standing on a planet's surface looking at this desert landscape in a spacesuit, and it's cold outside. You know, there you go. You are on Mars. And so I will never forget these moments where I put on the spacesuit, look out my visor, and share a moment of what hopefully future explorers will experience on Mars when they get there.
You know, tying all that together for our audience and space lovers and teachers. I mean, all these experiences you are doing field research for and doing this project for, I mean, it is really going to help us understand what Mars would be like. I mean, are there some very specific things that you're able to talk to the audience about that you're looking at with these studies?
Yes. And, you know, when you think about it, going to Mars is an expedition. I mean, you know, down the road, you might have big cruise liners going there with lots of people. But for the early missions, it's an expedition. And all expeditions, whether you're doing mountaineering or, you know, even a camping trip in your backyard, all expeditions are won at the planning stage. In other words, you really have to just plan them very carefully. And so one thing that we've learned from all these years of doing our studies on Devon Island is that, you know, being in the Arctic is already a very unforgiving environment. You know, you forget things that might be important for your mission. That's it. You won't be able to get them because you are lost in the Arctic. There's no Home Depot you can, you know, swing by to get this stuff. Now, if you don't pack your food that you need, you don't have food with you. If you're not careful and plan everything right in these types of expeditionary environments, you face cruel, certain, and unusual death. And that's nothing compared to Mars. That's nothing compared to Mars, because you're still here on Earth. You can breathe the air. You can, you know, there's still some running water in the wilderness from snow melt. On Mars, it is even much worse. So that's why Devon Island is a good place for training. It's because without being as deadly as Mars is, it's taking you a big step in the right direction to allow you to plan for that type of journey in the future.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Is that Space Dog? Oh my gosh, that's our cue. It's time to talk about students and what they have submitted for this podcast. This week, students were challenged to take a look at Google Mars and choose a location which they think is the best landing area and possible location for human settlement on Mars. We received amazing submissions. Science teacher Ann Seacat from the Girls School of Austin, go Girls School, and her entire sixth grade class completed the project for STEAM Space. Their submissions were really thought out. Go girls. I wish we could talk about every single one. I reviewed them all, and I know that you have too. And now that you've taken a look at them, Pascal, let's discuss some of the submissions you've chosen and give us your thoughts, please. I can't wait to hear who you picked.
Yeah, well, I thought everybody actually picked something really nice on Mars, and for good reasons. And that's maybe a reflection of the fact that Mars is such a beautiful planet everywhere. I mean, there's no particular part of Mars that I don't like. but I will point out that I was really impressed by a few submissions. I liked Aliana's very much. She suggested we land near a volcano called Apollinaris Mons. It's actually a very ancient volcano. It's pretty eroded, but it's beautiful. And so the landing site would be at the foothills of this volcano. You'd see it on the horizon in the distance. It would be a magnificent site to land at. I also liked Signe's site. She proposed to land on a highland area called the Sisyphi Planum. And that is one of the oldest terrains on Mars, one of the most ancient plateau tops that are left over from the early formation of Mars. And so it's the type of place where we might, for example, find signs of ancient life preserved in rocks at the surface of Mars today. So that's actually a really exciting site to go explore.
Cool.
And then Nina suggested we check out a site called Fortuna Fossae, which is a series of tectonic faults, very spectacular terrain with rows and rows of canyons and cliffs, a beautiful landscape, and challenging to explore, but very exciting. So those are the three that, you know, in my view, made the top of the cut. But I honestly really liked everybody's suggestions. Congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations, students at the Girls School of Austin. Great job and great hard work. So where is one of your favorite locations for landing on Mars, Pascal?
So my favorite location at this point is a place that we call Noctis Landing, the landing site of the night. Noctis, night.
That sounds like a sci-fi novel.
Yeah.
Sounds like a great one.
We love this site because it's low enough in elevation that you can land there. High sites that are too high in altitude are difficult to land at because you don't have time to basically slow down, open up parachutes, use retro rockets. By the time you do all that, you crash into the ground if you land too high. So you need a lower elevation location. But then this is a spot where if you drive east, or like I say, turn right, you go into ancient canyon country. And okay. You can look for signs of past life on Mars, fossils maybe in the rock layers of your canyon. If you drive west, in other words, if you turn left, then you go into volcano country. You can explore and find, you can find and explore caves. And caves are at this point probably the most promising place for us to find signs of life that might still be alive on Mars, not fossils. So for fossils, you drive west, east. To the right. For life that might be alive, you drive west, to the left. And that means that this is a very strategic location. It's lots to explore. And as we're about to announce next week in Houston, this is a scoop for you guys. Although I'm sure by the time you broadcast, if it's still going to be news, but we just realized that where we are there is the site of an ancient giant volcano.
Wow.
So that's super exciting because just like we liked Aliana's spot earlier with Apollinaris Mons in the distance, this is a place where the landing site is literally inside what used to be a giant volcano. And it was active not so long ago. I mean, even though it's ancient, it has been active for a long, long time. And so even recently, it was still experiencing eruptions.
Wow.
And so this is a very exciting place for us to go check out, I think, for humans.
Okay. So my imagination is exploding. I see so many things as an artist. And I just want to talk just a quick second, because you are an artist. And I was thinking about your discussion about isolation and psychological strain, being in close confined quarters. Like, how do you stay sane? Is doing art a way that you stay sane? Do you like sketch off these space images and Martian images that I personally love so much? Or do you paint at Devon Island? What do you do?
Yeah, so I love painting. I do find it very relaxing and enjoyable. When I'm in the field on Devon Island, I actually don't paint. I mean, I've painted occasionally, but I really don't have time to do that. I sketch. Yes, that I have time for.
Yeah.
And, you know, to save the idea for later and paint it once I'm back home. But when you're in the field, you're madly taking pictures of the landscape, planning your next outing.
Running from polar bears? Are you running from polar bears?
And my dog with me, and my dog is there to help us keep everybody safe from polar bears. So, you know, you're busy with outdoors life when you're on Devon Island more than indoors introspection.
That makes sense. I imagined you would have a sketchbook and making little thumbnail sketches. Well, I love your work. And I'm glad that you have that tool, because we all need those things when we're in physically strained situations, right? I have another congratulations for you. What a huge honor. You recently won the Carl Sagan Prize for Science Popularization from the SETI Institute. This was just this past November, right?
Yeah, well, I'm very humbled by it.
Oh my gosh, this is a huge deal.
But yeah, yes, I did get it.
What a huge honor. Like, just the fact that you did have the opportunity to work with Carl Sagan at Cornell, right? And for those of you who don't know, Carl Sagan was an amazing American astronomer and science communicator. He is known for so many things, including, I would say, my own personal narrator in my imagination. But one thing in particular was his contribution and his research to the possibility of extraterrestrial life, right? Intelligent life. I would say his contribution and his research to the possibility of intelligent life beyond our world and our solar system, right?
Yeah. Yes.
You were his last teaching student, right?
I was his last teaching assistant. Yeah, so that's an amazing experience. Carl was an incredible scientist. I just feel very lucky to have known him before he passed away.
What was it like to learn from him?
I mean, I learned so much from him. But the thing I remember is that, you know, he's best known for all these amazing books that he wrote. And I would still encourage students today to get a hold of some of his books and read them, because they're still very current. One of my favorite books that he ever wrote was The Cosmic Connection. It's a book that he wrote earlier in his life, before he became world famous. And The Cosmic Connection talks about his life as a planetary scientist and, you know, driving up one day to JPL one morning, because it was the day when, for the first time ever, we would see pictures from the surface of Mars. And so he was describing the anticipation, what would Mars look like, you know, now that we had landed there. And he nobody knew yet. They were going up to, he was driving to JPL to find out. And that is just so exciting, because, you know, at the time we had no idea what Mars was like. And since those first pictures, Mars has become a place. It's no longer just, you know, a little dot of light in the sky. It's a place you can go to. And so that is the book that convinced me that, you know, I should become a planetary scientist.
That's pretty awesome and inspiring. And you're a writer. You're a writer too, right? You've got a book coming out soon.
I'm no Carl Sagan.
Well,
I do write. Yeah, I have a children's book and I'm working on some other books. My children's book is published by Scholastic. It's called Mission Mars. It's about going to Mars and things you should know. And I'm writing for now an adult version of it, a grown-up version, I should say.
That's great, though. Yeah.
And, you know, grown-ups need more explanations than kids, so it's a bigger book.
I like that. Well, you'll have to come back on once you've published this book so we can talk about it again. Now, I know we're going to need to start closing up shop, but I do want to ask, what have I not asked you? I know there is always so much I forget. What have I not asked that's important? What do you want to tell us?
But I wanted to get back to a question you asked earlier, Holly, which is, you know, what is it like on Mars? The temperature, the atmosphere, how is it different from the Earth? I think this was a question from one of your teachers.
It's our essential questions for our teachers. So that's great. Yeah.
But let me say something about, you know, what Mars is really like and how different it is from the Earth. Because we go to Devon Island, but it's still not Mars. It's the landscape looks a bit like Mars, but it's far more forgiving. Mars's temperature on average is minus 80 degrees Fahrenheit or minus 63 degrees Celsius on average. The atmosphere is extremely thin. If you were to wander onto the surface of Mars unprotected by a spacesuit, the first thing that will kill you is the fact that the air is so thin. And all the gases that are dissolved in your bloodstream, the oxygen, the nitrogen that you just breathed in, would bubble up. You would fizz to death within a few seconds. If that didn't kill you, the next thing that would kill you is the fact that the Martian atmosphere does not have oxygen that we need to breathe, but carbon dioxide, which is actually poisonous for us. So you would die of lack of oxygen to your brain within minutes. If that didn't kill you, then the temperature on Mars will kill you, because on average it's minus 63 degrees Celsius, minus 80 degrees Fahrenheit, super cold. You are a human popsicle before the end of the day if you just stood on Mars unprotected by a spacesuit. And then if that didn't kill you, then the dust will. The Martian dust, as it turns out, is chemically toxic. It contains things that are called superoxides, perchlorates, peroxides. Nasty, nasty stuff. And that's why in the movie The Martian, by the way, the guy could not have survived by growing potatoes. First of all, he brought tons of Martian dirt into the cabin where he lives. By just breathing that dirt with the toxic compounds, he would have poisoned himself within a few weeks. So let alone eating the potatoes grown out of that soil. The Martian dust is something you really have to stay away from. A spacesuit helps, but if not, you're going to be exposed to it, and that's very nasty for you. Finally, if the dust didn't kill you, then the space radiation would on Mars. On Earth, we're receiving space radiation as well, but we're protected from it by two things. We have a thick atmosphere and a strong magnetic field. Thank you, atmosphere. Thank you, magnetic field. At the surface of the Earth, we're like onboard Starship Enterprise. The shields are up. We're protected. If you go to Mars, though, the atmosphere is very thin and there's no magnetic field. And so you're going to be zapped by space radiation at the surface of Mars unless you're properly protected. And that's very difficult to protect yourself. So for all these reasons, Mars is not at all as livable and pleasant as the Earth is. And you really have to plan your trip carefully. And I have serious doubts that we will ever really have large populations from Earth living at the surface of Mars. Some people think that, you know, that's somehow the vision that we should have. I'm totally into space travel and a big future in space, but I don't see giant populations at the surface of Mars. I think I see us hopefully mastering interstellar travel and traveling to planets around other stars.
planets that are much more pleasant than Mars.
I like that idea. So for Mars, I would say, why go with all those risks? But I think I might know your answer. What is your answer? Why go?
Why go? Because it's the closest planet to the Earth where you might actually find the first example of an alien form of life. We're not expecting little green men. We're talking about even little microscopic cells. But it would be life that is not of the Earth, different from all life on Earth, from a different family tree of life, if you will. And if you find that for the first time, that will tell you that life is not something unique to the Earth, but common throughout the universe. It's a big question that would be answered if you found even just one example of simple alien life on Mars. And I think it's a planet where we could actually find that.
That's a great answer. It kind of just made my mouth drop a little. And I'm a believer in that, of the quest and the hunt to see what's out there beyond us. Pascal, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a blast, as usual. I feel a little smarter. I'm very happy that you were able to come. And thank you for talking to our students. So, audience, if you like what you've heard today and what you've learned about, please consider following us on our Cities in Space Facebook page, as well as our Insta at Steaming for Space. If you'd like to support us with a donation as we seek to reach students everywhere, just visit our site at steam-space.org and hit support us. Every donation matters and helps us to produce new content and create aligned essential questions and classroom projects. You can also find our podcast on Spotify, Google, Apple, Amazon, and most popular platforms. Next month, we have an amazing guest for you. Melody Yashar is a space architect, researcher, and technologist at ICON. ICON builds 3D printed architecture and will be building us into our habitats and research stations on the moon and Mars. Special thanks to RNCN for producing this show, to Nate Zivin Productions for making our amazing music, and to listeners like you. I'm Holly Malier. Keep looking up.